Welcome to Mead House. Jeff here with my buddy Chris.
Hey, Jeff, how you doing today?
I am doing pretty fantastic. How are you?
It's been fantastic. I mean, all the tasks I have to do now, it's gotten warmer. Oh my gosh.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it just seems to get more and more.
The yard needs cleaned up. I told my wife I messed up yesterday. I went to run some errands. We were actually working on our saltwater tanks, and we have a little bit of coral that we were going to, like, so not to get all jingoing jargony with something that is not even related to the show.
Yeah.
But we were going to frag our coral, meaning we were going to take a little bit of this coral base and move it from one tank to another so we can get the coral growing in that tank too.
Okay.
And part of the thing you do for that is you get some of the gel-specific super glue to stick the coral, like, sample that you took to, like, a rock or a plug, so it's got something stable to start on, right? We were out of gel super glue. I went to Home Depot yesterday, and they were having a sale on Ryobi power tools. And last year, towards the end of summer, my lawnmower legit exploded on me.
Okay.
So I went to buy a new lawnmower because literally, like, chunks flew out of the engine compartment and nearly hit my foot. It was that bad. I don't know what was going on, but I was looking at lawnmowers and I was like, wow, these electric ones are not expensive. So I ended up with a Ryobi 40 volt and was like, well, this is, I took it home. I was like, okay, well, you know, this wasn't that big of an investment. I'm not expecting a lot from it. It is so quiet. It is so light. Mowing the lawn is like, I didn't spring for the self-propelled. I don't need it. This thing is so light.
Yeah, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, well, damn, now I need to get the other 40-volt Ryobi tools to match this one so that I can have, like, multiple batteries and swapsy-roozy and do whatever.
Yeah, your wife's not going to like that.
They had a whippersnapper on sale for $160, so I got one.
Hey, you're already on your way. Good job.
Yeah, I messed up.
All right, I'm going to bring us back to Mead here because
that's what we're
here for. Before we get started, I'd like to thank all our subscribers and listeners. We really appreciate you.
Thank you, guys.
Yes, we're going to go on tangent like this a lot. The longer you stay, the more you're going to know about our lives. Believe me. Anyway, but we do appreciate you. Keep listening. Keep sending in those comments. We want to know what you want to hear as well.
Absolutely. I love to hear the random snippets and, like, hey, you know, we were talking about this on a show 2 weeks ago, and that actually helped with that issue that you were having. And
Thank you. That is
the most gratifying thing to know that people are actually getting use out of this content, that we're not just talking to the void. Not that I mind.
We've been doing that long before we started this.
Right, yeah. Any excuse to hang out with a buddy and have a little drink or two.
Yeah, it never hurts my feeling. And second of all, we need to talk about Box and Barley Corn.
Absolutely.
Jake is there. He's been a strong and supportive, great guy. Love him to death. He's actually started me on, he wants me to start on ciders now. And I'm not sure I like him as much as I did before he mentioned that, because I don't need more hobbies. Now, I still love you, Jake. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I mean, cider is such an easy step after meat, though.
So. Yeah, I get it. But, you know,
you'll be okay.
Box and Barley has everything you need to ferment just about anything you want. It's rather amazing. They've got it for cheese, yogurt, mead, wine, and beer.
Right. I mean, they've got all kinds of stuff, whether you need ingredients, whether you need equipment, whether you have some questions or expertise. I mean, reach out to us for mead stuff, but if you've got any other questions, I mean, Jake and his crew have a ton of information at their beck and call. Bacchus of Barleycorn has been around for years. They are one of the oldest in the country as far as, like, homebrew stores.
Over 55 years.
Yeah, ridiculously long time. Jake is carrying on that proud tradition for them, and oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to have them as a sponsor.
And it's great. But if you go to Box and Barley Corn, you get your starter, anything, or you make a purchase, don't forget, you can get a discount if you go MHP
10.
I got the letters this time, but I forgot the number. MHP 10. Give yourself 10% off your order.
You can tell he's been practicing in a mirror at home.
Yeah.
Staring at himself angrily in the bathroom mirror. MHP 10. MHP
10. And I still fail.
Well, you know what will fix those hurt feelings?
Oh, well, you know.
It's the mead of the day. And today's mead is going to be from... Hey, that's a good pop.
That's a good pop.
This is a mead from Oppegard Meadery. This is Odensdager. I just got this from my mead club delivery this week. So I've been kind of eyeing this and like, oh.
This sounds really good. Look at that. I mean,
this is blackberry, cherry, and lime.
Yeah, it looks nice.
Yeah, Oppegard does a bunch of different lime, kind of, as lime as a secondary flavored mead that I have really enjoyed, you know, seeing. My wife and I kind of agree that lime as a flavor does not get quite enough love.
I really do agree with that. Lime is real. I enjoy lime a great deal.
We do a lot of lime related cocktails, especially now that it's getting into not just like spring, but warm summer weather. Daiquiris and
margaritas.
Well, yeah, oh, margaritas, of course. I mean, we drink margaritas in the winter just because you need something to
keep you warm.
The gin and lime.
Gimlet.
Gimlets, thank you.
Gimlet, yeah.
That's one of my life favorites. Yeah. Nice, like, fruity or herbaceous gin and lime juice.
Mm. Of all the things I learned in bartender training, that's about all I remember. Gimlet. Been that long.
Hey, you remembered it when I didn't, so, I mean, counts for something, right?
Yeah, it does. All right, now, the meat we have here is gorgeous red.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's bright ruby colored, very, very clear.
Yeah, I can see all the way through my glass, the fingers behind it. So. Mm-hmm.
Sheets the glass. I don't really see any legs on it. These are not obviously like, you know, this is Jeff's dishwasher clean, not like barware clean. Maybe a little bit of leg, but I think it's mostly sheeted glass.
Oh, smells nice.
Mm-hmm. I get cherry and blackberry on the nose more than lime, but that's not really a surprise. Lime is kind of a...
Lime doesn't smell much.
A little bit of honey on that.
I'm not catching the honey, but I don't smell as well as I need to for that. And so, let's see here. That lime is very forward.
Mm-hmm.
Not invasive.
No, it's strong. It provides, it's the acid balance in this meat. It really is. But it does kind of, it does a little bit overwhelm the blackberry and cherry, I think, as far as the flavor goes.
I can taste a little bit of the cherry in the back end.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really missing the blackberry overall.
The blackberry is not as strong. And I the aftertaste is strongly cherry. It has that kind of like a tart cherry kind of vibe going all the way down. As soon as you swallow, you get that, you take that breath of air and it's like cherry.
Yeah. So yeah, that's but no, don't get me wrong. This is good.
Yeah. It's good.
I would like a little more blackberry flavor in that
because
I'm really a big, I'm blackberry's king with me.
Blackberry is such a ubiquitous mead flavor. I mean, JD used to give people crap all the time about, oh yeah, don't make another blackberry mead, but there's a reason.
I love blackberry mead. I'm never going to get tired of it.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't mind a little more blackberry in this. I think this is a pretty stellar mead all by itself.
Oh, it's still really good. I'm not, oh no, send more my way. Hurt me.
If you told me this was just a cherry lime mead, I would say, okay, there's something else going on here, but I can't put my finger on what.
I probably couldn't have done that. But still, good mead.
Yeah. No, it's nice. It's an easy sipper for 14%, too.
It's a little bit higher than I thought it was.
That's trouble in a bottle.
Yeah. An F you up juice.
So hopefully this episode won't go too crazy here.
No, that never happens. No, that couldn't possibly happen. Yeah.
So, Chris, as we were wrapping things up last week, we talked a little bit about... how carbonation is a topic we need to chat about.
And that's true. Yeah. And I would love to get into that. Now, mind you, I've never made a carbonated.
Right.
I've tried once. What I made was carbonated liquid. It wasn't good. I mean, I let it sit for a year and a half and it still wasn't good.
Right. And there are two different approaches to carbonation. Mm-hmm. I think bottle carbonation is one thing, and bottle carbonation is kind of the easy way to get into this. I don't necessarily think it's the best way for a mead to get made. Because,
which is what I did.
Right. The good thing about carbonation in a bottle is that it's pretty easy to do. You need a like a capper, generally. Mm-hmm. You need some bottles. You need a basically finished mead with some living yeast still in it, so not stabilized. And you need something as a priming sugar or sugar addition. And there are, the great thing about this is that other people have made calculators out the yin yang for things besides just basic the corn sugar priming sugar stuff that you usually see at the homebrew store. You could add, if you want to, instead of using that priming sugar, you could use honey, you could use fruit juice, you could use all kinds of stuff,
brown sugars,
any of that.
This is stuff I haven't gone into, so
right. I know, like, my former co-host Ryan did a back sweetening with like cherry syrup in one of his stouts, I think.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, it raises the floor for the amount of different stuff you can do here. But there are a couple drawbacks. For one, we're still risking bottle bombs. So use the calculators, use them well. The thing you want to look out for is you want to know when you're looking at these calculators how much carbonation you want to add to the brew, and you want to know what kind of like sugar and timeline you're looking at to get that done. When you're talking about different carbonation levels, this is where you, as not a beer drinker, it's kind of at a disadvantage. Because when I say, well, this one I want the carbonation level of a stout, and this one I want the carbonation level of a lager, that means nothing to you.
No, less than that. It means absolutely nothing to me. But okay, just to educate me a little bit here, a lager or a stout, which one has more carbonation?
Lager.
Okay,
So
by how much?
generally, when you see like recipes or recommendations for the amount of carbonation in a lager or a stout, you'll see this measured in different ways. A lot of people will use like a volumes of CO2. So a stout, if memory serves, this is just my memory, this is not scientific fact. FYI, volumes of CO2 wise, a stout will have anywhere from like 1.8 to 2 volumes of CO2, which is kind of soft carbonation, whereas a lager will have something closer to like 2.5 to 2.75, depending on how carbonated it is.
Okay, so it's that's significant of it. Here we go. Well, what I'm doing right now is I'm pulling up a carbonation guide here to see if we can.
Yeah, the internet is a wonderful thing full of all these various different resources for us as homebrewers, so we don't have to figure this out ourselves.
Yeah, I mean,
Not
I
that
love
we.
math. Doesn't mean I want to do it in this moment. I'm doing it.
Right. And so the chart here that Chris has pulled up is basically like a volume of CO2 for temperature guide. And yeah, it's got darker ales, which is, stouts and porters and things like that, at 1.5 to 2.2. It's got most beers at 2.2 to 2.6. So I was in the right ballpark for both of those. And then highly carbonated ales at 2.6 to 4.0. But it doesn't list overcarbonated as until 4.1.
There's a gap there.
Yeah, there's a lot of carbonation. That highly carbonated ales leaves a very wide margin to hit. But let's say, we're talking about, well, we're going to use our Mead House 8%, for example.
Okay.
We're going to make a just a nice little summer sipper. We're going to be a carbonated kind of thing. I think we want about 2.5. We want in that most beers range, right? We want it to just be something that's bubbly and sippable, and maybe we'll go a little higher than that. So we can put in our calculator that we want 2.5% carbonation, and we have like a gallon of mead at 1.00 and starting gravity. I don't know if all of these calculators are this advanced, but we can use that to figure out, we need to add X amount of honey or brown sugar or fruit juice or whatever.
Okay, got
That gets us safe from the bottle bombs thing. The downside to this, though, is that in order to do carbonation in a bottle, we are still fermenting in the bottle. And
Yeah.
so you're not probably going to present a crystal clear mead when it comes out. It's probably going to be a little cloudy. You're probably going to have detritus at the bottom. You're almost certainly going to have detritus at the bottom. You could sit it in a refrigerator for like a week in advance of serving, and you could maybe get it pretty clear as long as you're careful about that last little bit of the pour. But it's not going to be the best presentation you can get.
Okay, the other way you do is you do it in the keg, the keg.
Yeah, kegs are the easy way to do this. You can take a stabilized and perfectly ready to go mead and put it in a keg, and then do the carbonation as an entirely separate step. That's why I like to do it, because I know what's going in is good, and the volume of CO2 is also going to have a protective effect against oxidization, and I want to say that those the negative parts of maturity of a mead, so it's going to last longer under carbonation. That surprise mead that we talked about a few weeks back, that's not the end all be all. I'm not sure that that was that great when it went in the first place, to be
Well,
honest,
that
but.
it was. How long was it in that thing, though? Come on, let's.
3 or 4 years.
Okay, there's a time issue here.
Yeah, no. Like I said, it's protective. It's not absolute.
That was a tough drink.
So
I
anyway.
cannot tell you. There's not enough O's that I can put in the word smooth to tell you how smooth it wasn't.
I was thinking of something else involving a lot of
Yeah, okay, that works too.
But yeah, no.
But there you go. I mean, but there is tables and charts to give tell you that much sugar,
right,
per bottle or you know carbonation keg or whatever you're doing
mm-hmm.
to get this
to add for your priming sugar, your bottle conditioning process. Yeah,
okay.
Pegging, it's a lot more expensive. There's no two ways about it because you're going to need at base value. You're going to need a regulator. You're going to need a CO2 bottle. You're going to need fittings and kegs and all the different hardware stuff. And chances are in this hobby, once you get started on this, you're going to want more kegs and you're going to want different kegs. And you're going to want maybe not only like carbonation stuff, but you might want nitrogenous stuff too.
Let's explain that.
For example, if you get a Guinness.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Guinness is not carbonated.
No, it's nitric.
It's nitrogenated. Nitrogen gas.
Nitrogen gas.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll get there.
Slow down.
By the way, my glass runs low.
Yeah, no, they use nitrogen dissolved into the beer liquid instead of carbon dioxide. That gives you a smoother mouthfeel, a creamier mouthfeel. It is not as stable, so it's a little tricky to get it like into the bottle, into the can. That's why you see the little widget things, because once it's in there, it's hard to like get the head to pour right too. That's its own thing, and I would love to try it. I've got a little 1 gallon nitrogenated keg that I tried a time or two, and it didn't really work as well as I wanted it to. So would love to play with that more in the future, but that's kind of stowed away deep in the back of the attic. So
yeah,
we've got a ways to go there as far as house cleaning goes. And that's another topic entirely. Yeah. Anyway, so kegs, you're going to spend some money to getting into this. Mm. A good regulator by itself, the last time my price went out, was going to start around $50, could go up to 100. A CO2 bottle, you're probably looking at 35. The cool part about this is that most homebrew stores have like a flip and trade deal going on, where if you bring in an empty bottle, they'll just trade out a full one. Last I checked, that was $20-$25.
Yeah, it's like getting the cans for the grill.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper to get to get a refill than it is to get a new one.
Right. So canister. There aren't a lot of the weird thing is there aren't a lot of places that you can just get a bottle refilled easily for CO2 stuff. I know there was a around here at one time, and it's been so long since I needed to refill a CO2 bottle that I don't know if they still do it, but there is a fire extinguisher company that will refill bottles.
Okay. Yeah. Well, basically, you're going to have to do an internet search and see what you can find in your
area. The other trick here is that your CO2 bottle has a four-digit number printed on it. The first two digits are a month. The second two digits are a year. That is the last recertification by the government. And that has to be recertified every 5 years. I have seen so many bottles going through when I was working at like Box and Barleycorn that they had to be like 30-year-old bottles.
Jeez.
That were still in service because they had the new date stamped, the new, like a collar around the bottle.
Wow.
Some of them you see that are brand spanking new and just have the new date. The trick is a lot of homebrew stores, when you take that bottle into refill, if it's about 6 months to the recert date, they will ask you to pay an additional fee for that recertification because they're going to need to do that to refill it. Most of the places that do the refilling in bulk, they'll say, okay, this is 6 months away. We're going to need to recertify this. And so
that's usually fairly minor and rather expensive overall.
So my big trick when I was working there and doing CO2 trades is that I would go to the fire extinguisher place for all my refills for a couple years at a time. And then once we got brand new stock in with brand new dates, I would do a trade with Bacchus and take my one that was certified 3 years ago, set that to be refilled, and get a brand new one that I could just take and refill and refill and refill for a few more years.
Cheating, but you know, if it works.
Got to game the system.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so you got your regular hoses, fittings, CO2 tank,
mm-hmm.
keg, And the math formula here.
Well, this is not even as big a deal for kegging, because it's a little tricky to read the volumes as far as just how much CO2 to put in at what temperature to get what you're looking for, if you will.
Okay.
This is the chart will not help as much for that. You kind of have to carbonate and play it by ear, if you will.
Really?
Yes.
That sounds horribly dangerous.
No, it's not. Your CO2 canister can hold hundreds of PSI of CO2. Your kegs can hold well above anything about serving temperature. The highest I've ever taken one to was 35 PSI. And even then, it didn't need to hold there for very long, like a couple days to get
it. But you have to bottle this thing after that keg. I mean, how carbonated is it going to be coming out of that?
You do want to run it off, and there are ways to bleed off excess pressure when you're ready to, you know, put it on a kegerator or serve it or stick it on a beer gun to bottle it. A lot of the lids for the kegs have a little pressure relief valve, like the little one with my carbonic maceration has a little ring in the middle you can pull to release some gas. The other thing you can do is just take a small screwdriver and get the middle of one of the posts on either side. To
bleed off.
So yeah, just bleed off. Be very careful with it, but you can easily get pressure off that way.
Talking about your little keg here with the strawberry and CO2, is it about the same way you're doing it with the carbonation for meat?
Basically, yeah. What we're doing here, I have a little, I don't remember if this is 1 gallon or 1.5 gallons, but it's a very small keg. It's cute. I got it on sale years and years ago, and we had my mystery meat in it for a little while. But this now has 4 pounds of previously frozen strawberries sitting at room temperature. I didn't find a really concrete guide for what pressure to carbonically macerate at. So I just said, okay, let's do 15.
Okay. Pick the number.
That was what my regulator was already sent to for some reason or another. So I said, okay, well, that'll work. We'll see what happens. This is very much it. We'll see what happens. Because yeah. I'm not even sure strawberries will work in this location.
In case you haven't noticed, there's a lot of, well, let's see what happens a lot in this field. Tracy from Texas, she will take a mead and she will do 6 to 8 bottles of that mead, testing for what works, what she wants for each one, and mm-hmm. taking measurements. I personally don't have that kind of room, but that's amazing to me. I mean, yeah. Just having multiple of the same, mm-hmm. trying to tweak in that at that level.
So now that we've got this in front of us, we're going to talk about this a little bit. We're going to talk about transferring under pressure too, which okay. is a cool thing we can do. Once we've got this as carbonically macerated as we want it, and it might already be that way, because I think this has been sitting down here like this for about 2 weeks now.
Okay.
I don't know how long this is supposed to take, to be honest. It could be ready to go. I just need a traditional kind of mead to get into this. And so what we're going to do, I figure I'll get 2 gallons of just a traditional mead.
Okay.
I'll put that in a keg.
Okay.
And I'll pressurize that keg and connect it to the infield line on this keg. From that keg into this one, and I'll lower the pressure here.
Okay.
That means the highly pressurized traditional is going to want to flow into the less pressurized mini keg full of strawberries.
Got it.
And we're going to sit in here, disconnect the two, and then I don't know how much contact time this needs. Maybe a week? Maybe a
pick couple a number,
days.
I mean.
Right. I might taste it after a couple days and taste and see what happens. Which seems like the way to do it. But at some point, we'll just put more pressure on the inline and move it to a bottle or a different keg or what, and we'll have a finished mead, hopefully, that doesn't suck and tastes like strawberries.
Oh, it doesn't suck, comma, and tastes like strawberries.
Yes.
Okay.
Two qualifiers there.
Two qualifiers.
Doesn't suck. A. It tastes like strawberries.
B. Yeah, B. Okay, because I missed the comma in that comment. Anyway, so... Okay, yeah, so carbonation, I've seen all of a whole bunch of levels of carbonation mm-hmm. at the competition. I've seen one that was so lightly carbonated, you don't know if they meant to do it.
Right.
It was just very, very light. I had one that gave me a shower.
Mm-hmm. And I, if I remember right, that was not supposed to be carbonated.
It was supposed to be still.
Yeah. This is the danger of carbonation either way. One of the reasons I like kegging as opposed to bottle carbonation is that even if you're using a calculator and you're being very careful, there is room for human error. Let's say you thought your mead was bone dry, but it has some residual sugar, so you add more sugar to it. When it's not quite done fermenting yet, what does that mean? You're getting more CO2 than you thought when it's all said and done. So, by the same token, other sugars, things like brown sugar or fruit juice, they're not as readily metabolizable by the yeast, if that's a word. I don't know.
Are they accessible?
Yeah, yeah. They don't metabolize it as quickly as, you know, freaking glucose and fructose and the basic sugars that we find in a lot of the stuff that we're using.
So the molasses is a harder pull for this.
Right. It may take longer to carbonate. You may let it sit for 3 weeks and be like, okay, well, this should be done, and it's not. And you, as a result, you have something that is a little flatter and a little sweeter than you thought it would be.
Okay.
So. The carbonation by keg, I like it because, you know, if it's too carbonated, bleed off a little carbonation, let it sit. If it's not carbonated enough, add a little CO2. I can fine-tune that. Really,
okay, easy. Nice. That's making it a lot more pleasant.
Yeah,
this is a great. I mean, anybody listening here, this is a great learning experience for me. I've never done this.
Yeah,
every single, I counted recently. I inventoried all my meads, all 11 and a half cases, and there are 14 different tastes, different fruited meads. And some of them have spice, some of them don't. Some of them have chocolate, some don't. But I have 14 different kinds in 11 and a half cases.
It sounds like you have a drinking problem.
Actually, my problem is I'm not drinking enough. That's my problem.
It's a different kind of drinking problem, but it's a drinking problem.
Yeah, and there's a problem. Deep Fried Dad only had like one bottle of cherry left.
Really?
So I had to go get some black cherry syrup. I have to make some more cherry because I'm not going to be out of that.
Cherry is one of the, you know, I think we'll talk about... soon here, we're going to talk about like refining and getting one of the things I like as far as an idea is just having like a few house meads, you know, like my buddy Chris comes over to my house. We're going to hang out in the backyard. We're going to grill some chicken and just shoot the shit. I want my buddy Chris to know there's always, you know, my lemon mead on tap. We can always go find a bottle of that to enjoy with something. There's always my whip beer braggot, even though you don't drink beer.
I enjoy the fact that you're enjoying it.
Right. There are like a handful of things I will always have available and will continually be just slightly tweaking to make it better, but we'll always have a reliable thing there to consume. I think.
And mine's like my blackberry vanilla.
Right. Yeah.
And my lemon ginger.
Mm-hmm.
And my cherry. I always want to have those at hand.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the point. We're going to need to talk about like refining those recipes, but we have, I think the impetus behind wanting to refine those is we have that house recipe that we always want to get. Right. Mm-hmm. We talked about carbonation. Let's switch topics and go to the other topic we want to talk about today, which was evaluating mead recipes online and why some of that weird stuff happens in there.
Yeah. First of all, no matter what recipe you get, it's not going to be the same result every time. The honey is going to be different.
Right.
The temperatures, unless you have very controlled circumstances for temperature, my basement's not the same temperature all year long.
No, it isn't. Your honey, especially if you're measuring honey by the pound.
Yeah, I've started doing it more your way and measuring by the hydrometer.
Right.
But I still like use. I my starting point is this many pounds.
Yeah.
Then I make a measurement that'll adjust.
Mm-hmm.
But by doing it by pound, like I used to do it, sometimes there's not as much or there's more sugar than the last time I used it.
Right.
So I'm going to get a different result.
The fall pull is a little more sugary than the spring pole versus, you know, orange blossom is a little less sugary than the hairy veach or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, those variations that come
and between. Plus, when you're getting the basic honeys like we tell you to get when you start up here, like I get from Restaurant Depot or Costco or whatever, those are blended honeys.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to get the same thing every time. I'll get something close.
Yeah. Close is not the same, though.
No, so close is not the same.
It's there is a level of variation in all of these that are present.
And even if I get honey from the same hive at the same time of year every year, it's not going to be the same honey.
Right.
Because it all depends on what the bees have access to, and nature is random.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can I make it consistently good? Sure.
Yeah.
Can I make the same flavor every time? Not necessarily.
Right. And so, you know, when you read one of the recipes that I published that say, hey, go to 1090 Stardew Gravity for this one, is it fine to say, okay, start with 2.5 pounds and then work your way up to 1090?
Yeah.
Sure. Why not? I mean, that's one of those acceptable cheats, I think, in my mind. I'm not saying, okay, well, you know, we're going to just ballpark this at 1090 and hope for the best. No, you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that's fine.
And definitive numbers are actually going to be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
When you take your notes and you say, yeah, I got this to 1090 with a 5% margin error thing, you're good. It's going to come out good.
Mm-hmm.
If you know, and honestly, if you got this, if you save a bottle of the last batch and you put it away and you get this new bottle made and you taste the two of them, the other one's aged.
Yeah.
It's going to be different. I mean, I've had my chocolate banana one I made. When I first made it, and I think I've mentioned this before, it tastes like you were eating a banana and washing it down with a Yoo-hoo soda. Now, it is wonder. It is so good. I mean, it tastes like a chocolate banana dessert you'd get at a restaurant. It's wonderful.
I have to give you props because I have never been brave enough to do a banana bead. I have seen too many pictures on Facebook over the years of people whose ceilings were redecorated by banana pulp to...
It's so scary. It really is. The first banana meat I made a 7-gallon batch. I put 12 pounds of mashed bananas in the bucket. And it was a constant flow of bubbles coming out of my airlock for 9 days.
Well, and
with a bulging lid with a 5-pound weight on, hoping it wouldn't decorate my ceiling.
And I think if I remember right, this is one where you asked me how much fruit as a guideline you should put in here. Because, you know, different levels of sweetness and whatever sugar from the bananas. I was like, I go, well, you're doing a 6-7 gallon batch, maybe 12 pounds?
Yeah, that's exactly what I put in, of bananas.
Of peeled bananas.
I peeled and mashed them myself. Oh, that was a mistake. I mean, it wasn't a mistake. It turned out very nice.
This was not my intention, though. My general rule of thumb was like, okay, you're going to buy 12 pounds of fruit at the store. You're going to peel it, and whatever fruit pulp you get is the amount of fruit pulp you get. No, you overachievered.
Yeah, again.
And you got 12 pounds of the peeled, pressed, ready-to-go fruit.
Yeah, it was all... I mashed it all with a potato masher, put it in a bag, put it... Oh, my God. I mean, the bulge on the... I was scared to death I was going to have an eruption. I was going to hear this boom in my living room at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
I literally put a 5-pound kettlebell on top of my bucket. It did not make the bucket lid go down. It was still bowed. My wife was mad because of the smell. I was terrified because of the bulge on that bucket, but it turned out pretty good. Oh, that was one of my successful near disasters.
So anyway, let's get to the second topic here.
Yeah.
When you look at mead recipes online, my research for this, I literally just Googled mead recipes. And I looked at, like... You know, there are some really good options on here. There are some really bad options on here. And when you're just getting started in mead making, how do you know what's what? You know?
That's really... I have a mentor. I have Jeff. I have Tracy. I have several of the people I talk to now. But if you don't have a mentor, you need to have certain tools in your belt.
Right. And there are a lot of context clues you can look at these recipes and go, is this a good recipe? Is this something I should follow? Or is this something I should be cautious about? And there are a few starter recipes that we could talk about. They're pretty famous. Joe's Ancient Orange, for example.
We can talk about that one in the future.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about that a little here because that does have a lot of stuff that are warning signs. But Joe's Ancient Orange is a meme in this community, in the idea of, like, it's one of those self-perpetuating thoughts. The idea was far more noble than what it became, I think. Not to talk shit about other mead makers, but the idea, as it was stated, was, hey, mead making can be simple. You can make a mead with basic ingredients from the supermarket. And as such, it has accidentally perpetuated so many bad techniques that people, you know, just they're cool with now.
But here we go.
So
something you can look out for in your when you get an online recipe, first of all, is your yeast.
Yeah, absolutely. You should be using a yeast that is made for making alcohol at the very least. I would recommend, you know, one of our tried and trues like 71B or K1V116
or D47.
Yeah. There are half a dozen of these guys that are tried and true, really easily accessible ones. Hell, you could switch things up a little bit and use a beer yeast too, as long as you're going like 10% or lower, or you just want a really sweet mead. Fine.
I don't like sweet mead. Yeah. No, there's no shame.
Yeah. Don't use bread yeast though. Bread yeast is not designed for making a mead. If they tell you to just use like the Red Star or Baker Special or whatever the hell you can get in little packets at your, you know, your local five and dime,
we'll call that a red flag.
Yeah,
that's. And in about a month, you're actually going to try a Red Star yeast mead because my son did this, and it's getting ready to bottle.
Red Star does make wine yeasts.
And he saw it, but he didn't pick that up on purpose.
To be specific, when we say Red Star yeast, we're talking about bread Red Star yeast, yes. Not like the de Blanc or whatever you can find at your home store.
Or the Fleischmann's or whatever, right. You know, whatever bread yeast. We're talking about bread yeast.
Yeah, that's...
I'll tell you...
Red flag.
That's a red light, red flag. Smelling my son making that bread yeast mead smelled like bread. And not necessarily good bread, but it smelled like bread. It's bread yeast. I mean, it's what it's for.
So the thing about yeast, it's been, I don't remember exactly when microscopy got to the point where we could isolate the yeast were a thing and that we could do like slats and petri dishes and things like that to like cultivate them that way and like, isolate the spore strains and reproduce them. But we have been selectively breeding
yeast for a purpose, and the purpose is wines and beers.
Accidentally, without knowing that yeast were actually a thing, just from the practice of making it over and over again, we've been selectively breeding these guys for centuries. The same way we've been selectively breeding dogs for hundreds of centuries.
Yeah.
Probably.
But the point is, we are in the modern world. Use the modern stuff. Right.
You don't want to send a chihuahua to herd sheep.
Yeah. But what's another thing you need to look out for? I mean, other than yeast.
One of the really common ones you'll see for very old recipes, directions to heat your water, your honey, or your must, the mixture of water and honey.
Yeah, they boil it frequently in the old recipes.
They will boil it or they will heat it to a high temperature. Why do you think you would want to do that?
The only thing I think of is decontaminate it, but...
Right. It's the idea is a level of sterilization, I think, is where that came from. Because honey has a lot of different stuff in it. And the fact of the matter is that the reason honey is so good at being a sterile dressing for first aid or something you could basically keep stored for centuries is because it is...
It is the ultimate supersaturated sugar solution.
Right. And so any contaminant, whether it's bacteria or yeast or fungus or whatever like that, when it gets in contact with that yeast, it will get the water sucked out of it. And usually that will kill it outright. Sometimes it will put that in suspension. And so if you've got enough of something in there and you then rehydrate the water.
Rehydrate your honey.
Right. Then the balance is thrown off. Those things in suspension can get rehydrated too, and they could take over.
And we told you before, when you're doing your fermentation, you want your yeast to be the first one to take over.
Right.
That's the control you want. If something else beats the yeast, it's a bad batch.
So I can understand the logic of wanting to heat stuff up. It's just not necessary. And you're losing something really nice in the process, which is all those great little volatile organics that make honey smell like honey, taste like honey, that give it all that character.
Yeah.
You want to hold on to those.
And I've actually tasted one of the things I'm going to use in Homestead very soon is metal foam honey, which tastes like marshmallow.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you ferment it. Unless you heat it.
Yeah.
You do one of those things. It's honey, but it doesn't taste like marshmallow.
You lose a lot of that special character to it.
Yeah, and I don't want to do that.
We want to hold on to that. So don't heat stuff up. You don't need to do that. That's an extra step. You know, sanitize your tools, your fermenter, your mixing stuff, your all your tools and hardware, things like that. Yes, that is generally almost always 99.99999% of the time enough to stop the contamination that this practice of boiling or heating stuff is like thought to
permit. To help you with.
The only other reason I could think someone would want to heat things up is to like make it easier for the honey to mix. But that's why I have a power drill.
Yeah, I can mix up my 7-gallon bucket with my hand,
mm-hmm.
with a long stick. I've got a drill. So it saves me a lot of time.
Another one that is, we could, again, indict Joe's Ancient Orange for this one, is adding raisins.
This is a topic for me, because I've had excellent mead, good mead made with raisins.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what mead magic he does. It was in the light of a full moon, in the presence of a left-handed virgin. I don't know what he does, but it's good mead. However, he's the only one I know that does it. This is the only guy I know that does it and does it well.
Yeah. The idea behind adding raisins, I think, is twofold. Again, there's some sense to this. There's some logic to this. It's just not a great practice. On the one hand, and the reason you usually see people in a misguided way trying to do it is to add nutrient. The yeast is lacking a source of nitrogen, an assimilable nitrogen that it can use to do its metabolizing sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide, right? The problem is that, raisins are sugary. They're not that sugary.
They
don't have that much like nitrogen stored up in there that is easy for the yeast to break down and use. The better source, the better reason to add raisins, I think, than anything, is just a little extra tannin.
It's got a lot of skin there.
Yeah, that's all grape skin, pretty much. And a little bit of...
And that works. I mean, again, my buddy, Brian, he makes his basic, and it's honey, water, raisins, and he makes a good mead.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the only one I've ever seen do that, do it well.
No, I think if you're going to add raisins to a mead, it better be a raisin-flavored mead. And am I talking shit a little bit? Yeah. But by the same token, I think like some mixture of raisins, figs, and dates in a dark mead that's like very sweet, very high in alcohol, that would be a delightful
good
drinker. Yeah.
That sounds good. The basis for a fruitcake mead.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no objection.
A little cinnamon, a little nutmeg, and we're talking business here.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, we're ready to go.
So raisins have a place in mead that's just not as a nutrient source. I think they're an okay tannin source. The other thing that you'll see sometimes, I didn't see actually any in my cursory Google search, but I've seen a number of people recommend it, again, as a tannin source, brewed tea.
Yeah. I actually made a Earl Grey tea, mm-hmm. Earl Grey mead recently. It was Earl Grey Moonlight Mead. Delightful. It was good. The little bit I had left over, I'm going to let it sit for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to bring some over as soon as it has time to mellow.
Looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to sharing it because I'm sitting here. I can do this again.
Yeah.
And actually, the next time around, I'm going to add lactose to it and make it a London Fog.
That'll be fun.
Yeah,
it'll be
fun.
Now, when you added the tea, you added loose leaf tea in a straining bag?
Yeah.
Okay. That, I think, that's a great practice. I like that practice. I've done that myself. That is not what I'm talking about here, though.
You're talking about brewed tea.
Yeah, I'm talking about get some Lipton's in a cup. Make a cup, like a coffee mug size cup of brewed tea. Take the bag out, pour the brewed tea into the mead.
Okay.
It's a tannin addition.
It's a tannin addition, but I don't see what else. I don't see the big difference between what I did with the loose leaf and what you're doing with the brewed tea. What is the big difference?
The idea here is to put some tannin up front rather than like as a flavoring thing. And the goal, I think, is not to have the flavor of the tea as much as just the tannin addition.
Okay, fair.
Fair. Of all of the weird things you see in mead recipes you can find online that are kind of red flags, I don't know that this is as much a red flag as it is a
Cautionary
tale. Let's call it a yellow flag on the play.
Okay.
Because there are easier, better ways to get better tannins into your mead. You could use tea as a flavor if you want a tea-flavored mead. And tea-flavored meads are delightful.
And they're shocking because this sounds counterintuitive. Tea-flavored honey wine sounds odd.
No, it doesn't. That sounds...
Tea and honey works together, but a wine sounds odd to me. But it works. It absolutely works.
How many times have I said, hey, you should add some oat?
Yeah.
Because you should add some oat. Even if it's just a little, even if it's just for a little while. A little extra tannin rounds out things. It kind of smooths out the harsh edges.
And that's actually something I'm learning a lot of right now. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to add oak into things. My next round of blackberry vanilla, I'm adding oak for the first time ever.
I need to tell you about the weird thing I decided to try with my, what I'm going to be doing next month.
What's that?
So while I was on vacation a couple weeks back, we went to a brunch place called Ruby Slipper. We were out at Gulf Shores in Alabama, and they had brunch cocktails.
Okay.
And so at first I wanted to get an Irish coffee because I was still going to get my coffee fix, but I was going to get a little booze, right? And I ended up getting they were out of, I think it was the Irish cream or something like that. So I was like, okay, well.
That's almost hypocritical or sacrilegious or
I know.
At least bad.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, let's do, and I looked and I saw a lavender Paloma cocktail. Paloma being like grapefruit and tequila.
Yeah.
And that was friggin' delightful.
Okay.
So next month, I think I'm going to make a grapefruit mead. I'm going to tincture in some lavender just to get enough lavender so it's, you know.
It's present but not overpowering.
It's present, not grandma's perfume. And then I'm going to age it on some light American oak that has been soaking in tequila.
I'm intrigued.
I think this has promise. I hope it turns out as nice as I see it in my head. It's going to take some tweaking, but I think that's the goal for this year anyway, is to kind of make that vision in my head come to reality in a more consistent fashion.
Well, right now my current vision is my banana nutter butter, mm-hmm. which is still giving me fits. Oh my gosh, I hate peanut butter. But yeah, I'm looking forward to yours. I mean, that sounds really good.
We will figure this out on both our cases.
Yeah.
But yeah, no.
I'm going to get us lab coats because, you know, why not?
So those were the main warning signs that I saw as far as things that give us red flags as far as, hey, this recipe is. And I don't want to sound like I'm talking shit because I think these are made with good intention, but not necessarily the best practice or the most modern practice. And I think a lot of people that are sharing these, even in a modern context, I mean, here's a fun challenge. Look up the recipe for Joe's Ancient Orange and then look up mead making recipes. See how many times in the first two or three pages worth of results you have on Google, you see people using the recipe for Joe's Ancient Orange without even crediting the recipe Joe's Ancient Orange. It gets reshared all over the place by people that actually, they're not making mead, they're making content.
And, you know, again, not to diss people who make mead. If you're going to do a flavored mead, like the one thing we're on for a while that's pretty popular was a Mountain Dew mead.
Mm-hmm.
Don't use Mountain Dew.
No.
Use the Mountain Dew flavors, the grapefruit, the citrus, the lime, the flavors in it to make your Mountain Dew mead.
Right.
Don't use the actual product of Mountain Dew, in my opinion, because you're fighting against a whole lot of preservatives and stuff that you really shouldn't have to fight against.
I know you watch food YouTube. Are you familiar with Claire Saffitz?
I've seen him.
Her.
Her. Sorry. I've seen them.
There's a whole long backstory, but she used to be involved with a different company. I don't remember the name of it. But she used to have a series with them called Homemade But Better or some variation of that, where she took a popular snack food, whether it was like Doritos or Hostess Cupcakes or whatever, and used a gourmet process to make a better version of that. You as a viewer at home with, you know, maybe a few tweaks and hacks here and there could make a gourmet version of this that was better than. I think that's the approach we need to take. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do Mountain Dew mead, I don't want mead that tastes like Mountain Dew. because I don't like the taste of Mountain Dew. But Mountain Dew in general has, you know, let's analyze it. It has a strong citrus punch.
Yeah. It has orange, it has lime, it has grapefruit. Right. That's its citrus.
Right. And it has a kind of a sharpness to it. It's a very carbonated, bubbly kind of thing. So we want those flavors. We want to kind of tweak the mix maybe.
And stop fighting what's, you know, already present in what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to fight the preservatives, why? Why don't you just use the flavors and make it directly? Don't put more work for yourself.
Right, right. I think the idea of fermenting something that is already preservatived up and just a common product you can easily get is a little clickbaity. I don't want to talk shit about other creators here. But
you know, by the same token, Max Miller, who does Tasting History, mm-hmm. no shade. I saw him make an old meat recipe where it was a black meat, where he boiled the honey and water until mm-hmm. it was black.
Right.
I'm not saying that. He was sitting there, okay, it's interesting. I may try this in a while again, see how it mellows out over time. Kudos, man. I'll toast my honey. No problem.
Right.
I'm not going to boil it black because I just can't.
We don't need to get it to hardball stage or whatever you see with, like, freaking sugar dessert making. Yeah.
I'm not throwing shade against Max Miller. He's doing traditional recipes from ancient times, mm-hmm. how they did it. Cool. Let's do the make it better
right. thing. Yeah.
That I like that much better.
Yeah. Let's elevate the game.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like we said so many times before, rising tide raises all ships.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be nice to have an orange and lime and grapefruit little easy carbonated sipper for a hot summer afternoon?
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Sounds delightful. I hate Mountain Dew, but I would drink the hell out of that.
Oh, yeah. And I'm told, and this is just a cursory research I did, there are 250,000 kinds of fruit in this world. We're not going to run out of ideas anytime soon.
No. No, I think we are safe.
So bring it. And that doesn't even count the spices, man.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, geez, we could go to the Price Chopper down the street from me here. We could find, I guarantee, at least a dozen different kinds of fruit and, you know, 20, 30 different kinds of spices just there. And how many different combinations is that alone?
Yeah. It's the mind boggles. And I wish I had an elven lifetime to try them all, but I don't. So I'll do the best right. I can.
Yeah, no. And, you know, again, hey, reach out to our community.
And
guys,
try it with us.
Try stuff. Tell us what you found, what you like. And, you know, you and I may not like the same things. You may like your raisin mead just fine and think that I'm, you know, being a snarky old man yelling at clouds. But you know, this is community makes this happen, and community helps us try some of these different, you know, 250 different fruits and 50 bajillion different spices in combination and figure out what's good.
Yeah. And so that we're going to do that. I think that's kind of soon. We're going to talk about odd things you can put, they've been putting in meads over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll delve into that. And maybe some of the reasons why it'll be a light touch. I like history, but I'm not a historian.
Right. And I think we've already talked about some of the historical things from different cultures, so it'll be a kind of a riff on that to some extent. But
yeah,
that'll be fun. And I think, you know, next week, though, I think we should talk about something we can do with that 12% now that people have had some time to get that going.
Okay.
We let that out last week, I think.
Yeah, I think it was.
So next week, let's...
No offense, guys. If you it's like, don't you know when you did your last show? Yeah, but we've done a few shows now. So we got to keep things... And she's done a lot more than I have. We've got to keep things straight. It's hard.
The editing process, I mean, you know, you guys are listening to our episodes once each. I'm listening to each episode probably 3 or 4 times.
I generally listen to it 2, maybe 3 times on a good time.
I don't like the sound of my own voice enough to do that.
I'm just trying to reintegrate the information I learned at the time so I keep it on hand.
That's fair.
But, you know, so I listen more than once, but I'm not really terribly fond of my voice either, but I'm trying to filter out that part and listen to the information coming at me and turn it. Need input. Anyway. But, thanks for joining us. See you next time. Jeff,
honor being here. Good night, guys. We'll talk to you soon.